So the listening heart So this morning we chanted the precepts, we took the refuges, and I think it's really in our engagement in everyday life that we put our understanding of these precepts and our understanding of mindfulness, we really put it into practice. And in our conversations, those who came to the interviews, we really saw some very powerful examples of that. So the listening heart, you know, the listening heart really refers to the heart's ability to know what is needed, when it is needed, and how we can give. And that's how we live our understanding of practice. Sometimes even really surprising ourselves by our ability to meet life and open to the fullness and the mystery of it. So I really see this as a creative potential. Mindfulness not just as a means of becoming a little more stress-free or calm, but it becomes a beautiful mirror reflecting back to us the unique opportunities we are presented with to maintain and nurture and develop the human heart. Yesterday at the talk I gave at North Island College in Courtney on mindfulness and the creative life, I spoke about mindfulness as an apprenticeship to wonder. And I really think that, I mean, you may have had this experience today stepping outside and just experiencing the wonder and the beauty of life and of our gift of sense perception to be able to feel the wind, hear the sound of the trees, experience the sky and the air. This reverence that is nurtured in opening through mindfulness to the world around us, it really cultivates a sense of abundance. Like, how much do I really need to have my health, to have shelter, to have good friends? It's remarkable. So this appreciation and gratitude and sense of abundance can actually bring us to a place of action and stewardship. This is my world. I live in this world. How am I caring for it? In the Buddhist tradition, we speak about this idea of bodhicitta, and that is the awakened heart, the heart that knows that our individual practice is never for ourselves alone. So when I was a child, there was a book I read and reread, which you may know by the title of Sarah Crewe. Anyone know that book? Or it has another title as well. And the story, it moved me because it inspired me to imagine myself as an anonymous benefactor who would slip into someone's home, someone like a neglected orphan or a weary parent or some world-weary, jaded business person, and slip into their home and light the fire in the fireplace and prepare a tea tray covered in good things to eat and slip away, and then maybe from some corner of the room or out the window, observe and watch as they came in and were surprised and taken aback by this feast and this delightful, enchanted setting. And so I'd imagine myself doing that, and sometimes my mother, you know, had come back from grocery shopping and she'd had to answer the phone, and I'd quickly and try and put away the groceries, and oh my goodness, you know, that kind of thing. But then we had a cousin, my mother's cousin, who went out to India to work with Tibetan refugees. Actually, some of you may even know her, because she used to speak at events here in Victoria. Judy Taitong. She lives in Machosen or Langford. And she went out as a young woman in the 60s to work with Tibetan refugees who had fled the Chinese invasion of their homeland. And she stayed for many years, and she married a Tibetan. And she used to write us these amazing letters recounting the challenges, the difficulties, the needs of the refugees. And she invited many members of her extended family to adopt, in a sense, or to send a monthly donation to one of the Tibetan children she knew. And we did, and this young girl wrote to us. And it was so sweet and so lovely to receive her letters written in her, you know, halting English and her very careful penmanship, and these blue airmail letters that would come to us. So something was stirred in me by that experience. And when I was at university studying philosophy and theater and linguistics, I had this thought, oh, my goodness, this is so self-indulgent. I should really do something. And I wrote to the organization that my mother's cousin Judy had worked for, CUSO, and asked them if, you know, is there anything I could do? I'd studied philosophy and theater. And they said, get your degree. So I finished my degree. And it was so interesting, you know, that intention and that seed planted. And when I was finishing my degree, and I was finishing it at McGill, there was a poster in the lobby of the arts building. And the poster said, urgently needed English teachers for CUSO Nigeria, minimum requirement, a BA in English. And it was April. I was about to receive my BA in English. So by August, I was on my way. And of course, my mother was like, what are you doing? You know, she was not pleased. But off I went, and we were 60 Canadians who went out that year to teach English, all with different motivations. I mean, I admit my motivation wasn't completely pure. I wanted to be a writer, and I knew that writers have to suffer. So I thought, well, I'll just go and do some suffering. I'll get it done, and then I'll come back, and I'll be a writer. And I did suffer, believe me. I mean, I had a home of my own, though, which was pretty nice at 22. There were papaya trees in my garden. There was a cashew nut tree, flame trees out the front window. I had 150 students, and I learned each of their names. Names like Mohammed Ibrahim, or Ibrahim Mohammed, or Mohammed Mohammed Mohammed. And a few Christians. Sunday Moses was one of them. And I had been convinced that, having had no training as a teacher, that this was actually an advantage. It was not an advantage. But they respected me because I came on time. I wasn't a particularly skillful teacher, but they were just fascinated by me because my skin was white and my eyes were blue. And some of them would just sit and stare at me in class. So this seed of a desire to be of service, and it continues, you know, it's there, and interesting, when I worked as a cook at the retreat center in Massachusetts, at that time all the staff were completely volunteers. There was an administrative staff, but the cooks and the groundskeepers and the people in maintenance, they were all working as, they were all donating their time. Of course, we did have meals covered, accommodation covered. We even had free acupuncture, which was very nice. But at the end of the month, we would receive an envelope with dana, with a gift from those who attended the retreats. So they would give a gift to the teachers, and they would give a gift to the staff, and it would be divided up among the volunteers. And it, for me, it just made me so happy to work freely, to serve the meals, cook the meals, and take out the big pots of rice and vegetarian fare, and to see this as my contribution to their practice, knowing many of them were psychotherapists or worked in medicine or healthcare or were teachers. We had one Catholic priest who came, knowing that their practice would benefit hundreds, if not thousands, of people. And so there we were, supporting them. And it made me so happy, and there was this feeling of selflessness that arose. Like, it's not really about me and my wages. It's about being part of this gift. So this, some of you know this book, One Dharma, by Joseph Goldstein. Joseph was often there at the retreat center in Massachusetts because he lived next door. He would sometimes come through the kitchen and just put a hand on my shoulder and say, "How are you doing?" And I would bemoan some recent disaster, like having made, too much of something or burned something else. And he was very, very kind. And later on, when I was living in Cambridge, there was a book signing for him at the Cambridge Insight Center. And I went to hear his talk and bought a copy of his book. And he signed it for me. And he wrote to Marco, "Thank you for your great service to the Dharma. Much metta, Joseph." And so that struck me. Oh, somehow Joseph perceives me as being of service to the Dharma. And it took me a long time to realize what he meant, what that meant. And it didn't mean, because you were a cook or because you do some volunteer work. What he really was referring to is this visible commitment and ongoing engagement with transforming my own heart and mind, and in that way being of service to the world through my practice of the Dharma. And I think that's really what we're doing here. We're transforming the forces of greed, hatred, and delusion that are so firmly rooted in our world and in our culture. We're swimming against that stream of me and mine and what's in it for me. We're transforming that. And through even the way we listen to each other, something as simple as listening without interrupting, or listening and inquiring with a real genuine interest to another. Something as simple as that can transform a relationship and can open others to the possibility of listening with wholehearted presence. So this is really what happens when we deeply commit to a practice like this. In surprising ways, we impact and influence others So we plant, this is Joseph saying, we plant this wonderful seed of bodhicitta, relative bodhicitta, and that is the motivation to practice for the benefit of all beings. And he simplifies it, he says, we plant this wonderful seed of relative bodhicitta. He calls it the kind heart. And slowly it will grow and mature into the guiding principle of our lives. Even at those times when we're not acting from this place of wisdom and compassion, bodhicitta can still be the reference point that reminds us of other choices. One Tibetan teaching sums up the power of this practice. Let those who desire Buddhahood not train in many dharmas, but only one. Which one? Great compassion. Those with great compassion possess all the Buddha's teaching as if it were in the palm of their hand. So this is from the 9th century Chinese Zen master Rinzai, who expresses the creativity and unlimited potential of a person not imprisoned by the notion of self. So not me, not mine. If a man comes to me asking for the Buddha, as a man of no reliance, that is, as a man who isn't attached to an idea of self, I present myself in a state of purity and cleanliness. If he asks for a bodhisattva, I present myself in a state of mercy and benevolence. If he asks for bodhi, true wisdom, I present myself in a state of purity and an exquisite superbness. If he asks for nirvana, complete enlightenment, I present myself in a state of utter serenity. Though there are hundreds of thousands of states, as a man of non-reliance, I am always the same. Therefore, my presentation of various states, according to the requirements, is just like the moon that freely presents its images on every surface of water. So, a little bit obscure perhaps, but inviting us to see how the needs of the moment don't have to be anticipated, don't have to be prepared for, so much as preparing the heart to be responsive. A few years ago, I gave an evening class, and one of the topics we addressed was this idea of aloneness. And I think that we mistakenly perceive ourselves sometimes as struggling alone or figuring things out alone. But it is always, there is this invitation to recognize that whatever challenge or difficulty, whatever obstacle is before us, others have encountered that obstacle. I was quoting some lines from a poem by David White, which I read yesterday for my presentation at the college. And one of the things he says is, put down the weight of your aloneness. Step into the conversation. See how the soap dish enables you, how the window latch grants you freedom, how the stairs are there to frighten you and invite you. he says about the cooking pots. They have left their arrogant aloofness and seen the good in you at last. Everything is waiting for you. So this beautiful reminder that even the inanimate world is charged with personality, and depending on how you view it. I mean, I remember at the end of my longest retreat, in which I had suffered the usual encounters with fear and anxiety and shame and boredom and restlessness and elation and exhilaration and joy and all those things, all those appearances. At some point, I was able to let go of the story of me and my retreat and my Vipassana romance and all the various appearances in the mind. And I began to notice objects in my surroundings. The doorknobs, they just seemed to be so saucy. And the meditation cushions, they looked so cheeky, as if they were going to, at night, as if when the hall was empty, they were going to get up and start dancing. And if someone had pulled out one of the wooden chairs from the table and it was slightly askew, and I would see it and I would look again as if, well, was it going to do some tap dancing? Or so the world became alive to me in the most delightful and playful way. And truly, a quantum physicist understands that particles are in motion. Everything is in motion, no matter how we view things as stable and fixed. So meditation invites us to this perspective and this seeing with new eyes, putting down the weight of our aloneness and recognizing that we are part, as Mary Oliver says, of the family of things. Sokni Rinpoche, a Dzogchen teacher whom I've had the fortune, good fortune to practice with a few times, he says, bodhicitta is a profound and vibrant alertness that absolutely cuts through all the mental and emotional residue that tends to cloud our normal awareness. So this alertness that recognizes interconnectedness, that recognizes our potential, our creative potential to engage with the world. It's a state of awareness in which we see quite clearly the various strategies we typically adopt in order to get through the day. And it's really, if we come back to the Noble Eightfold Path, it's really about right view. And right view is really recognizing the truth of suffering, recognizing that all beings are born, will age, and will die, that all beings recognize that they are part of this continuum. And right view is inviting us continually to remember that our actions have results. So the truth of karma and this lens of the Four Noble Truth, that's right view. So this is a quote from Dag Hammarskjöld. Do you know how to pronounce that? Hammarskjöld. So, he says, I don't know who or what put the question. I don't know when it was put. I don't even remember answering. But at some moment, I did answer yes to someone or something, and from that hour, I was certain that existence is meaningful, and that therefore my life in self-surrender had a goal. At some moment, I did answer yes to someone or something, and from that hour, I was certain that existence is meaningful, and that therefore my life in self-surrender had a goal. This is from Tanisara's beautiful book, Time to Stand Up, an engaged Buddhist manifesto for our earth. She says, as we enter the reality of our times, we are like Siddhartha that morning when he walked the marketplace. Seeing death and decay all around, he was shocked out of complacency. As we let our new reality sink in, it is a terrible, terrible shock. And she's speaking here about the state of the planet. It's an unbearable blow that can fill us with despair and disbelief, with anger and rage, and with a confusing contradiction of impotency and urgency. The last few years, she writes, I have often woken at night in a sweat, unable to digest the enormity of our suicidal trajectory. And yet in daylight, it all seems normal. Life continues as if it always will. But we are like sleepwalkers heading toward a precipice we know is there. The question is, can we wake up in time to avoid falling over it? The Buddha demonstrated his ability to walk this world without fear and hatred. His intent was to alleviate suffering. We can do the same. After his enlightenment, the Buddha understood that to live without anything to serve is to live unhappily. In considering what to serve, he realized that he could serve the Dharma. To serve the Dharma is to serve all life, regardless. The Dharma is the deeper truth of life. If we listen into our heart, it will guide our way. So let's just sit for a couple of minutes. To serve the Dharma is to serve all life, regardless. The Dharma is the deeper truth of life. If we listen into our heart, it will guide our way. Thank you for listening.